Did you get the thing?
Yes, I got the thing.
Feed the dog?
Yes, I fed the dog.
Did you download the episode?
Yes, I downloaded the episode. What's up with the questions? Can we just go, please?
Me here and now to promise as a good comrade and a fellow artist that I will not report any of this, whatever it is, to the police.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast. Each week, our intrepid group of researchers and archivists sift through the album crates of the world, finding those records that may have been lost over time. Our team also seeks out up-and-coming artists with work we feel you should know about. When we're lucky enough, the artists swing by Thunderlove Studio to chat with our hosts, Keith R. Higgins and Jeff Calhoun, about those albums and their careers as a whole. Sit back, relax, and thank you for joining us.
Growing up, Jeff Eyrick had one career in his crosshairs, and he was only ever going to be one thing, a musician. Moving to Los Angeles right after high school, he found immediate success. As a bass player, Jeff toured and did session work for artists like Tim Buckley, Air Supply, Bette Midler, and Rick Springfield. Sliding easily into the producer's chair, Jeff's first producing gig was the legendary album Everywhere at Once by the Plimsolls. He would go on to produce artists as varied as those he played with: T-Bone Burnett, The Blasters, and Cheech and Chong. Jeff also produced the album that got our podcast rolling, the debut album by Broken Homes. It's safe to say that without Jeff, we wouldn't be here now. After 2 decades of production and music supervision work, Jeff once again began playing a lot of bass. Although he hasn't stopped producing, he spends a lot of time these days playing. In 2023, he released the sprawling 3-volume set Rogers Street. Keith welcomed Jeff back into Thunderlove Studio to talk about this new work and his entire career. Here is Keith's conversation with Jeff Eyrick.
It's just the normal noises in here.
Are you from Los Angeles?
I'm a California native. I was born in Torrance, California, grew up in Long Beach, California.
Okay.
So, when did I move up to Hollywood? God. Sometime in the early 70s, I think. Mid 70s, around that time. But I was playing gigs up there. And one time I was playing like a club gig in the lounge of the Continental Hyatt House on Sunset. And this guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, I'm looking for a bass player. Would you want to come and audition tomorrow?" And it was Tim Buckley.
Wow.
And so I was still living in Long Beach at the time. I went and auditioned and got the gig. And that was ascending to the next rung, where I was touring and playing with somebody who was kind of known out there in the...
Yeah, and you have played with, as an artist, Air Supply.
I played on their first American record, yes.
Big Joe Turner.
Oh, yeah.
Keith Carradine.
Yeah, Keith Carradine.
Was that a vanity project, or was he
No. He did a movie called Nashville.
Yeah.
And in the movie, he sang a song called I'm Easy. And he's actually a singer-songwriter as well as an actor.
Okay.
And so I played on his second record, and then we did a tour. You know, we played the Bottom Line. We played clubs like that all over the country. So the thing about Joe Turner, just going back to that for a second, in L.A., before Buckley, this is probably the late 60s, very early 70s, I played with in a band called the Ice House Blues Band, which was James Harmon's band. James Harmon, pretty well-known harp player, blues guy from Alabama. I met him. It could go way down in the weeds from there. But we were a traditional Chicago-style blues band. I mean, James was a purist. He said, look, if you're going to play with me, you got to come over to my house. I'll play you the records. You got to learn the bass parts. I didn't realize it at the time, but this was a great background to have that blues root in my playing and to understand and to just really get that. We would get calls from Bernie Pearl at the Ash Grove. Hey, I've got Joe Turner coming in. Would you guys come and back him up? I got Big Mama Thornton coming in. Would you guys come back? I'm John Lee Hooker. So I got to play with all these guys.
Whoa.
Yeah. And we knew the material. I mean, we knew it like the record, you know? So it was great. And it was great for them too, because a lot of times these guys come to town and get a pickup band that's terrible. And, you know.
That must have been a pretty heady experience playing with these guys who helped shape ostensibly rock and roll.
Yeah, I only wish that I had more appreciation at that time. I mean, I was a real young, wise ass, you know, and I thought, you know, who are these old guys, you know? I just hadn't educated myself to the point, and I kick myself because, I mean, to go along with that, I met a keyboard player. There was a guy named Pat DeBuono, up in Hollywood when I moved up there, and he had a regular gig with the Bihari Brothers. The Bihari Brothers were, I mean, they were kind of the equivalent of Chess Records.
Okay.
But they were out in LA at that time, and we would get a call. Hey, we got Lowell Fulson coming in. Can you guys come in? And we're going to make a record with him today, you know? And they had a really funky studio, 8-track studio, 3 of the tracks never worked. And we'd come in there and we would do, you know, me and a guitar player, drummer, Pat, we would do these records for this small blues label, where we would just record the record all in one day. You know, we did Lowell Fulson, Joe Turner, Charles, what was his name? The piano player. He did Merry Christmas, Baby. God, I can't believe I that was his big hit. But I also remember that one hand he could reach 2 octaves, the biggest hands I've ever seen in my life. this was really funny. I remember that. I'll never forget this. He used to go, this was a really big studio, like an old warehouse that they turned into a studio. We would just be in one little corner. And I kept seeing Charles go to the back and kind of crouch down behind one of the gobos. And I got, what the hell is he doing? And so one time I went back there to look, and he was back there drinking, and he didn't want to influence us young kids.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, that was good. But, in terms of my approach to playing bass and stuff, having that blues background, and even to this day,
yeah,
I'm thankful for that.
I can't get them to stay focused. They keep escalating the conversation into evil curses and opening leather shops in Arizona.
A leather shop in Arizona?
Yeah.
Well, they'd be out of business in a week's time.
In Long Beach, mid to late 70s, there was a punk thing going on there. Was there not?
Mid to late 70s, I was in Hollywood.
Okay, you were gone by then.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah. By 75, I had moved up to, I was, you know, living in, I think, Studio City or, you know. Okay. Then I moved up to Laurel Canyon. And so I was up in Hollywood then, and then my career had moved on to more studio musician. After playing with Buckley, I was, you know, from time I would kind of go back and forth from going on a tour with somebody, and then I'd get tired of that, and I'd come back and just say, okay, I'm going to stay home for a while and just work in the studios, and You know, so it was kind of back and forth like that.
We played with Natalie Cole, Tanya Tucker.
Yeah, Tanya Tucker was great.
You segue into producing. How did you bridge that gap from being exclusively a musician into exclusively producing?
I was working, doing a lot of session work for a producer in Hollywood, Spencer Proffer, at the Pasha Music House. You know, he told me, he said, I would come in and play on records for him. And he told me, he said, man, if you ever find somebody that you want to produce, he says, I got a lot of free time open and, you know, you could just take the time. And the only thing I ask is if it's turns out to be something I really like that I get a first shot at signing it. I said, dude, that's great. And, I had friends who I thought were pretty good. Who I would bring into the studio on off times and just maybe record a few songs. And one time, well, it started this way. The Plimsolls had just finished their, I think it was their second record, or maybe their first record for Richard Perry's label, Planet Records, okay? And they were about to do their big record release party at the Starwood in Hollywood, okay? And their producer and manager was a guy, Danny Holloway, a guy that I grew up with and used to surf with and play with. My first bands, I was, you know, Danny was the bass player, I was a guitar player. And so Danny calls me and he says, dude, you got to help me out. You're the only guy I know that can learn 18 songs in one day. he said, David O from the bass from the Plimsolls, the bass player, got in a fight last night and put his hand through a window and broke his hand. He can't play. But we got this big show. So I told him, I said, okay, I'll do it. So I did it, met Peter Case, found out that, you know, where I lived in Laurel Canyon, I could kind of see where he lived, right? You know, we could just not even walk on streets, just walk across the field to our houses. And he came to me and he said, hey, I got this new song I'm working on. And he played me Million Miles Away. And I said, dude, that's awesome. And I came up with a bass line for it. He said, if you have any ideas. And I came up with a bass line and I thought, wow, this is a great song. So I thought we should go and record this at Pasha. Mikey Davis, who went on to like engineer and produce Kiss and stuff like that, at that time was the assistant engineer, just a young kid. And he said, I can come to the studio like at midnight and let you guys in and we can record something. So it was like that, you know, and I think we did it over a course of 2 days or something like that and recorded a Million Miles Away. And I remember Spencer found out and all of a sudden we were kind of in trouble. And then we kind of smoothed it over and I said, hey, could we get Larry Brown, who was his ace engineer and mixer, to mix it? And when the guy that was managing the Plimsolls at that time heard the song, he wanted to, you know, take it to get it released. So that first version of Million Miles Away was released on Bomp. That kind of started the whole ball rolling. And the Plimsolls at that time were a very, very popular band in Hollywood. And their shows at the Whiskey were legendary. And as a matter of fact, I recorded one of them, a live record that you might see sometime, came out much later, but
okay.
Yeah.
So that version of Million Miles Away that you, is that the one that makes it on the Geffen record, or did you re-record it?
We didn't re-record it, but we remixed it.
Okay.
Yeah. For the Geffen record, we were working with Greg LaDonne, and because he didn't record that song, he was a nice guy, but he really had kind of an attitude. Mm. And so he wasn't that, you know, and I think he was under the influence of some drugs that might tend him to kind of crank the high end a lot. But anyway,
so while you produced the Plimsolls version of Million Miles Away, you told me before we started that you had only heard the Goo Goo Dolls version live.
Yeah. A live version. Yeah.
So let's play this for you now and get an immediate thought on what the original producer thinks of it.
Okay. Where are those guys from? They're from Rochester or something like that, right?
Buffalo.
Buffalo, okay. Faster.
Yeah.
Oh, they changed it. They left part of the one of the lines of the chorus is out.
Oh. It's a lot more energy.
Yeah, it's faster. Probably more like the Plimsolls live.
Ah,
everything is. Let me hear this chorus again. Okay, I got it.
Yeah. So what do you think of that after having produced the original? Rufus.
Faster. So it's got more energy, I think. The guy's voice sounds to me a lot kind of like Peter Kay's. But what I miss is all those cool Eddie Munoz guitar parts. Those, you know, the lead guitar player in the Plimsolls, it was a great guitar player. Still is. So I kind of miss those little answers that, he, you know, not a big deal, but I mean, it's okay.
I might submit they probably didn't have the musical acuity to to do that sort of.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I mean, when we did Million Miles Away, I think the Plimsolls have been playing it for probably about a month.
Oh, wow.
And so on their live shows, I mean, they were ready to do it. But it was still relatively fresh also. So I was able to get a lot of energy. Peter Case, one of the best singers I've ever worked with in terms of getting right to the right energy level. I mean, all the tracks on that Plimsolls album, it was just a joy to work with him. Just because you didn't have to get him up to the, you know, he would just go right there, you know. And I love the sound of his voice, a lot of energy in his voice.
When you go in to produce a band, mm-hmm. like the Plimsolls, do you go and watch them rehearse and give them notes? It's like, hey, maybe you should do this, maybe you should do that.
Pre-production? Yeah. Yeah.
You do?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I like to be, you know, as much inside the music, and also, you know, just give them, give them the input from the outside, but from somebody who's musical, not to change anything, but I just want to figure out where they're coming from, and I want to help them get what they want to get out of it, but also I want to help, you know, I got to have the consideration of the record company too, because they're looking for, they're looking for product they can sell, basically. Even though that's not ever been my MO in terms of producing, maybe to my detriment, I don't know. But I listen to the band. I see them live. I work with them in the rehearsal studio, and then, you know, basically we go in and try to capture the best version of that we can, maybe looking forward to how good they're going to be in 6 months of playing it, you know. So
I remember watching a documentary about Rick Rubin and his studio up there in Malibu. It was about the Abbott Brothers documentary.
Oh yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, and he's just sort of sits back there and he talks about how he produces by the vibe. And yeah. Rick Rubin, whatever you, I have my own particular thoughts about him. He's an institution. I'm not necessarily sure how one produces by vibes, but that's his thing.
Every situation is different. I that's what I find. And I mean, sometimes, God, I've produced projects where, you know, I've wound up doing like a lot more than I would normally do. But that's the way the artist kind of wanted it, you know. I think a producer has to be ready to find his place to fit in. I mean, I did a record with T-Bone Burnett, Proof Through the Night, and I mean, he had the musicians that he wanted to use. I had to, in a way, I wanted to kind of like stay out of his way so he could do his thing and then just find the right places where I had to move in and give him, you know, fill my role, you know, which was basically, give him the input on the vocals. If there was something in the arrangement that I was hearing from the control room that he might not be hearing out in the studio, that kind of stuff. I frequently would be out in the studio with the band, with a lot of the bands that I produce, because I, being a studio musician, I was used to hearing it in headphones out there playing. You know, so I would like to be out there with them. Plus, I hated the, you know, turn on the talk back and you're talking to everybody's hearing it in the headphones. And I know how it is out, you know, everybody's, you know, oh, geez, you know, what's this guy talking about? And so I like to just be out there and just react right with the musicians in the room.
Okay.
So if I can do that on a record, I still like to operate that way, even though the whole production thing has changed nowadays. So it's a lot different.
Clearly, obviously, it's changed post-COVID, but had it changed prior to that?
It changed. There was less of that, get, you know, five or six guys in a band together in the studio, hash it out and work it out and record it. It was more, you know, do your demos at home, which a lot of records I would do, that people would send me the stuff. I would work on guitar parts and bass parts and stuff like that in my home and then take it to the studio. Or I would go, I would go over to the guitar player's house who plays the pedal steel in his studio and work on it. And then go to the drummer's house and say, okay, I want to take away these drum loops and put real drums here. Or can you play along with this here? But we'll keep the bass drum electronic. That wasn't happening back in the, let's say, the tape days.
Right.
You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I go back to those days.
Mm-hmm.
For my money, being in a room full of great musicians, being one of those guys, and that group thing, you know, like this studio looks like it's perfect for that.
Yeah.
That's still, to me, the best. You know, there's a spontaneity you get. There's a magic you get when that it really gels and it happens, you know? And I don't know in modern music how important that is anymore.
Well, I can speak for myself as a fan and a rock and roll fan. It's very important to me because I like to think that I can hear that.
Yeah.
As it comes through in the song. It's like I don't get the same, it seems a little bit more sterile with some of the rock songs that are recording.
Yeah. See, I guess what I'm hearing from what I, you know, the stuff I listen to, I'm hearing more of the, like, hip hop and pop and stuff like that. And it doesn't seem like that spontaneity thing, that kind of group magic is important in that kind of music at all. You know, that to me seems like it's more constructed. They get a track and then it's up to the guy who's rapping or whatever to make it happen, you know?
You know, and the other thing I think that's missing, and I've talked about this with a few other folks, is when you're recording like that, mistakes happen. And sometimes the mistakes are best left in. I mean, it's wonderful.
I'm with you on that, man, 100%. You know, there's always stuff like, I've had this conversation with so many artists. They'll come in and say, oh, I screwed that up. I go, you know what? In 3 months, you will never hear that. It'll go away. It'll go right by. Leave it. It's really, it's like, you can't replace that. You know, it won't happen again. There's something else going on here. That's higher level. So let's just, you know,
for sure.
So
did you continue to play?
I played on so much stuff. I remember one time I got called to play on a Bob's Big Boy commercial. You remember Bob's Big Boy restaurant?
Yes.
Okay. Bob's Big Boy commercial, 9:30 in the morning. I walk into the studio. Earl Palmer on drums.
Wow.
James Burton on guitar.
Jesus.
Just the three of us. You know, like a 30-second spot.
Yep.
We were done in 5 minutes.
No. Got a lot of good food, big boy. Hurry down to Bob's Big Boy. Got a lot of good food, big boy. Hurry down to Bob's Big Boy. Got a lot of good food, big boy. Hurry down to Bob's Big Boy. Got a lot of good food, big boy. Hurry down to Bob's Big Boy.
Was your full-time focus more on producing or playing, or equally divided after you sort of became a producer?
I was leaning more towards production.
Okay.
That being said, I will say that I don't want to get specific about this, but I played a bass on a lot of the productions.
Okay.
Some that you would probably be surprised to hear about, as with the bass players. But anyway, no. But I mean, frequently, there would be issues that I knew that I could solve very quickly. And, you know, I would just, you know, take the, you know, when somebody was out of the room, I would just, you know, fix things. But at the same time, if I got a call to play, I was always happy to do that. As a matter of fact, that was nice because then the pressure was off in terms of having this whole project, being responsible. I was just like one of the guys.
As a producer, are you a technical person? Do you know all this?
I kind of purposely avoided that, the engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Up until recently, now I'm fully on with the digital stuff. I'm, you know, Pro Tools and all that kind of stuff. I'm conversant in that. So I would always work. I preferred to work with an engineer because I really wanted 100% focus on what was going on in the studio. And like I was telling you, frequently I would be out in the studio, so I didn't want to have to either be going back and forth, or I just didn't want to, I always tried to find, I realized early that having a good engineer that you could trust was the best way to go.
You hold the distinction of being the producer of the record that spawned this podcast, the Broken Homes record. We won't take a deep dive into it, but I still love that fucking record.
I do too, man.
I still think it's one of the
best. You totally brought that back up to the surface for me, and I really appreciate it because that, God, even today, that's a great record, isn't it?
Stands the test of time as far as I'm concerned. 100%.
Yeah.
My question around that, and it circles back to the Spencer Proffer Band Rhythm Corps.
Okay.
Correct me, I'm paraphrasing. You weren't entirely satisfied with Craig Aronson's drumming, so you brought in Don Harvey.
Right.
Similarly, the Rhythm Corps record, Common Ground, and the single Common Ground, it was recorded and mixed by a guy in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the producer of the record, but the band was adamant that this was a better version, even though they recorded a new version with this producer, and they went to loggerheads over it. And the band eventually went out because Spencer stepped in and said, the guys feel really strongly about this, let's do it. My question, I'm going to approach it as delicately as I can. Where does the moment of objectivity, or subjectivity rather, end? Because if I'm a producer and I hear something that's better than what I did, I would be like, that's better. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, is it a financial thing? Is it a point thing? Is it a pride thing? Is it, what is the motivation behind that?
I personally think that you have to lose all ego when it comes to making those kind of decisions.
Mm.
If something is better the way it is, then, you know, okay, give it a try. But I mean, don't, you know, with Craig Aronson specifically, if you want to talk about that.
Yeah.
And you know, he's no longer walking the earth. So,
sadly, but...
I mean, he rest in peace, Craig. And he and I patched things up after the fact. He was working as an A&R guy at Capitol Records and all that stuff. But I knew from the first time I saw Broken Homes that that was going to be a problem, because I felt like in their live shows, I felt like he was in a way kind of holding them back. Just, he wasn't, it wasn't, the groove just wasn't happening. Those other guys were playing at a level that they needed more solid support. And but we gave it a try, and I just knew that I went in and talked to the A&R guy, Michael Goldstone, and I said, I'm really sorry, but Michael, I think, knew, because he was very experienced, had made a lot of records, that this is not an uncommon thing, that the drummer, young drummers who have never recorded, sometimes can be, you know, a weak link.
Yeah.
More than sometimes. So I said, you know, I'd like to, I've been doing a lot of work with Don Harvey, and Goldstone just said, you know, do what you think is the right thing. I said, well, I need to know if you're going to support me, because they're going to come to you and say, hey, this guy's crazy, get rid of him. But you know, when those guys played with Don and they heard what he did, they got it.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I told Craig, I said, dude, I said, it's tough. I said, I know, because I've been through it and myself. And so I said, the best thing you could do is come to the studio and make Don your best friend and listen to what he's doing and try to understand it. You know,
did he take you up on that?
No, it's, you know, it's a hard thing.
I want to ask you about one production in particular that seems funny to me.
Okay.
Cheech and Chong. What was the scene like in the studio when you're recording them?
They knew they were going to break up. They were going to part ways. They weren't very friendly. As a matter of fact, they were never in the studio together.
Really?
Yeah. And in terms of the stoner part of it, neither of them were like that. I mean, at that point they were, you know, and I think they knew this was their last record for MCA. So, and I was working with Chad Blake, and we were at the, Chad is, an amazing, I mean, he works now with Paul McCartney and Peter Gabriel, and incredible engineer. And so we would record Tommy's. Tommy would come in and record his parts. On another day, Cheech would come in and record his parts, and then me and Chad would edit it together, and just to kind of get the timing down. Wow. And then either Tommy or Chad or Cheech would come in and say, "You got to tighten that up," or whatever. And they were doing like skits on that record, and there was musical interludes. And me and this keyboard player wrote a lot of the music that they needed for that. That's how that went down. That wasn't as an organic Cheech and Chong, you know, like telling jokes together, and
it doesn't sound like it was very fun either.
It wasn't. I'll tell you what was fun. Born in East LA was fun.
Took a walk to the corner store just to buy a loaf of bread and a box of s'mores. I pulled a guy in a yellow van, shiny gold badge flashing in his hand. He said, "All right, all you more nothing more, so answer in English if you can. Where were you born, man?"
"Huh? Where was I born?"
"That's right, I said, where were you born?"
"Hey, are you one of those dudes that do horoscopes, man? Hey, I'm a Cancer with a bad moon rising."
"Look here, Elfago, watch my lips. Where were you born?"
"I was born in East LA, man. I was born in East LA."
"Yeah, you're born in East LA. Well, let's see your green card, huh?"
"Green card? I'm from East LA."
"All right, well, then who's president of the United States?"
"Oh, that's easy, man. That guy that used to be on Death Valley days, John Wayne."
"All right, let's go. Come on." "Next thing I know, I'm in a foreign land."
That came after everything was done. Everything else was done. Cheech came to me and says, "Man, I want to do I don't know if he had had the idea for the movie in his head already, but he came to me and says, "You know, we got to do one more. I'm trying to get the rights from Bruce Springsteen to do, change the lyrics and all that." I got him. I said, "Okay, well, let's do something different. At that time I was playing bass in a band called the Surf Punks. I was living out in Malibu. So I was, working with Dennis Dragon a lot, who was the drummer in the Surf Punks, and he had played with the Beach Boys. And if you look up Dennis Dragon,
it's not.
No, it's the Captain's brother.
Oh, it's the Captain's brother.
Okay. Yeah, they're a whole musical family, the Dragons. And Dennis is really an amazingly great engineer, but really a character. Okay. And you can do nothing about he's no longer with us either, but you could do nothing about his personality. It was just the way he was. I totally got it. I liked the guy. I had known him for a long time. I play a lot of gigs with him, crazy fucking punk rock gigs with the Surf Punks.
John Cale.
Yeah, that was a weird one because I had moved to New York. Joel Mark worked at, what was the name of that label? Creed. Remember the band Creed?
I remember the band. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That label.
Can see the logo almost.
Yeah. Anyway, the A&R guy there, Joel Mark, we became really good friends. And he said, "Hey, Jeff, I'm going to produce some John Cale tracks. Would you come and play bass?" And I go, "John Cale." I thought he meant JJ Cale.
Right.
And then John Cale from the Velvet Underground. I said, "Yeah, man, totally." So yeah, that was just that. And at that time I was actually, managing bands too, as well as producing and playing. So I got involved with a company in Stockholm. One day I was on the beach in Patmos. I was in those days, this was in the mid 80s. I would go there to windsurf. So I'm on the beach getting ready to go windsurfing, and all of a sudden I hear the Gun Club, Las Vegas Story. And I literally had just finished that record months before that, just maybe 2 months before that. I'm going, how weird. Patmos is a little tiny island, man. No airport. It's really off the radar, especially back in the mid 80s. And how is it I'm hearing this, somebody was playing that record from the house that was right across the street from the beach. So I walk over there, and it's these two Swedish girls, Åsa and Anna. And I go, wow, how is it you guys have this record? Oh, our boyfriends are in a band in Sweden, and they want this producer to come and produce their band. And I go, unbelievable. I'm the guy that produced the record.
Wow.
And they said, oh, my God. They said, well, they're on tour right now somewhere in Europe. Those guys came to Potmos, and we met, and we just like, you got to talk to the label head, Peter, and we want you to come to Sweden and produce. That was my connection with Sweden. And at the time, in the studio, there was a guy, Per Kvimen, was like helping out in the studio, you know? And so I met Per, met the whole Swedish gang. Imperiet was the name of the band. And they were a big band in Sweden with a long history. Few years later, I get a call from Per. Jeff, he said, we've got this. I was still living in Malibu. He says, we've got like four bands now signed to American labels. This was when, remember that time? I think it was like around the mid-90s when Swedish bands were popping up. They were getting signed to Hives, all these Swedish bands. Anyway, Per said, I'm about to sign another band to Island, and we need somebody to be to handle our management in America. But you're going to have to move to New York. So that's what got me back here. Okay. And so I was working in management. Let's see, we had Salt signed to Island. Clawfinger was, I think, Polygram. We had one band signed to, it wasn't Metal Blade. There was another metal label. Eric LeMasters was the guy that was running it, I remember. But we had, anyway, so I was responding, and another band signed, there was another, like a metal band signed to Geffen. And then we had another band called Drain, which was an all-girl heavy metal band.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we got them signed to Tom Zutaw's label, The Enclave. You know, anyway, I'm doing all this management stuff, you know, working in the inside the record company on the corporate side, not the creative side. So I'm getting to see what was happening with my records or the records that I would produce once they were turned in.
Seeing how the sausage is made.
Yeah, not necessarily made, but how they were going to sell it. You know what I mean? How are they going to package it? What kind of, you know, I'm sitting in these meetings. And as a musician, a lot of the times I was fucking cringing, you know? That management thing is really cutthroat. Anyway, that lasted about 4 years, and then I like had it.
Sometimes it takes every ounce of tact I can muster to keep everyone contented.
I gave you that Dave's True Story CD. Mm-hmm. That woman is somebody that I was living with, and the lead singer in that band, and I would just, they would have rehearsals at our house, and they didn't have a regular bass player, and they would just, the bass players were so bad that they were, and I said, you know what, my bass is in the closet over there, I'm gonna play with you guys.
Okay.
You know, just so you have some sort of regularity and somebody who knows how to play.
We've done our time. There's nothing left to mend. It's no big crime. It's just the way things end. So despite the mauling, it won't be falling apart. It's just a small black heart. It's not assault. It's not like Rome was burned. It's no one's fault. No need to be concerned. so forget the soft shoe dance. Cause there was no real chance from the start of such a small black heart. Small black heart.
So I started playing with them, and then I because of the management thing, I started thinking we can do something with it, you know. So they had been functioning together since 1989, so they had built up a lot of goodwill, especially on the East Coast, east of the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And Dave Cantor, genius songwriter. I think Robert Christgau said, Cole Porter meets Steely Dan. You know, it was a perfect.
Yeah.
If you studied Dave's lyrics and then Kelly with her, the way she sang and stuff, it was great. I loved that. And that wasn't really my kind of music, but I just loved the vibe of it and really got into it and produced them and kind of managed them and played bass with them. So.
Your work.
Okay.
Your first album, this one you gave me.
Electro.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So back in 2015, the guy that I partnered with on this, there's a CD in there, right?
Yep.
Okay. Thank God. Okay. The guy that I partnered with on this, Steve Kirkman, really good friend of mine, great guitar player, great guy, great songwriter, love the way he sings. He's from the South. Real rootsy. He lives in Paterson, New York. And so he had a little studio called the Octagon in his backyard. And he would call me up sometimes and say, hey, could you come up and put bass on this record for me that he's producing or something like that? So I go up there. And I remember one time I was messing around, you know, warming up or something like that. He says, what's that? I go, oh, it's just nothing, you know. He goes, hey, would you play on one of my tracks? And so he put on a track and I put a bass line on it. Wow, this is good. Hey, you know, maybe you should put this guitar. Anyway, we started collaborating like right away. And the result was, this. And this was at a time when I was collecting analog drum machines, the old style drum machines before digital. They have a feel, you know? And I was collecting them because I loved playing with them. And so on Electro, I said, let's not work with a drummer. Let's work with these analog machines. Let this will be our concept. Me and you and this drummer, you know, I'll play upright bass. You on guitars. Steve also has, he's got I don't want to tell you how many guitars he's got, a lot. All kinds. Yeah. And so we made this record, and it, you know, we just kept recording, and then at a certain point we said, yeah, we should put this out. And it was at the tail end of when you would put out an actual physical CD. So we did some shows, and it was one of those things where people would say, wow, love that CD, it's so good, but I couldn't get any traction, really. So
it's a great sound.
Yeah. I mean, Steve and I are really good friends, and we show up on the same bandstand together sometimes.
Awesome.
Another fork in the road. Gotta make a decision. Times are growing old. My cars are swerving, going side to side. Getting faster and faster, but the brakes applied. You know there's an eagle flying over my head. Yeah, sometimes she likes to see me sweat.
hundreds of miles, logged under my hood, tried to get back home every chance I could.
That brings us to Rogers Street.
Yeah, okay.
Now, so you've dropped 3 records and an EP in the past August,
2 months.
2 months, yeah,
yeah.
First question out of the gate, Rogers Street.
That's the street I live on.
Take note, everybody.
Yeah. Rogers Street. At the beginning of the pandemic, okay, I think that was, were we going back to 2020 there?
Yep.
2020. February 2020, something's going on here, folks. I've got this calendar that's full the rest of the year, all these gigs. By, I think, March 10th, all gone. I go, fuck, what am I going to do? You can't go anywhere. Guys are calling me up. Hey, the studio's closed. I can't do any sessions here, but can you do bass tracks remote? And I go, I got to get into this now. This is something I should have done years ago. And so I call my guy at Sweetwater. I go, Ikes, I got to be able to record bass tracks in my house. I got a little interface. I got the software. I find this guy on YouTube. I keep seeing this guy, Tim Talks Audio. And then one time I go to his website and I see he's in Edison, New Jersey. I go, oh shit, that's close. So I call him and he goes, yeah, I do consulting, you know, I don't know, $50 an hour or something like that. So basically I invested the money to, you know, he gave me the fast track to learn too. And I had been, you know, keeping my eyes on for years and years, the engineers, especially when the Pro Tools came in, what they were doing and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, how they would set the limiters and how, you know, what the compression was doing and all kinds of stuff like that. So, I jumped into it at that point. And then, you know, I had my, you know, I started out as a guitarist, so I've played guitar first. I only switched to bass when I was 18. I always had, you know, my Stratocaster and my, you know, some other guitars and a lot of acoustic guitars.
Just switch to bass out of necessity or out of choice?
I was playing with, in Long Beach, California, I was playing guitar with the Alexander Patton, Alexander Soul King Patton Review and Dancers. Okay. This was a full on R&B, you know, like, you know, how come you got those white guys up there playing in your band? But anyway, the answer to that was because we had a rehearsal room and we had good instruments. And we were reliable. So anyway, one night I came to that gig and the bass player didn't show up, but his bass was there. And Alexander said, man, he says, I need a bass more than I need the guitar. Can you fill in on bass tonight? I played bass on that gig that night and I just totally fell in love with it. It just turned myself around to a different thing. And so at that point I, went out and bought a Fender Jazz bass. And then like a year later, at 68, I traded the Jazz bass in for a Fender Telecaster bass, 1968 Fender Telecaster bass, which I still have, is my bass. So my A bass. Yeah, that's how I went from guitar to, but I had a long, you know, I played piano from 6 to 10, 6 years old to 10 years old, then started on guitar. So I had played guitar for a long time. I had played guitar in a lot of bands. So I understood the guitar, which was great for bass because then, you know, you learn the chord structures and, you know, a lot of different note choices that most bass players might not, you know, be aware of and all that kind of stuff. So, anyway, that's when I switched to bass.
So the pandemic is hits?
The pandemic hits. I took a couple of months to really kind of get conversant in that. And then I just started recording stuff. And, I recorded a lot of stuff, even more than what's there in the release. And at a certain point earlier this year, I just said, God, am I just going to sit on this stuff or what am I going to do? I was doing producing Linda Draper's record. And Linda would send me guitar voice demos that I would get her to record to a click. And then I would load them into my system and I would, you know, build the tracks around that. And I remember we had Dave Bennett to mix. And once I got done recording all the stuff, he would say, man, the stuff sounds really good. Where'd you record this? My house. Oh, sounds great. And I go, you know, tell me if something's fucked up. Oh, I'm sorry. Is that okay?
You can swear.
Oh, okay. No. Tell me if something's fucked up. And he says, no, man, it's good. The levels are all good. You got it. So I thought, okay. I was listening to when Robbie Robertson died. Rest in peace, Robbie. He was talking about the second band record. And he was talking about how they went to all these mastering guys to get it mastered. And people would say, it's too screwed up, man. I don't know. What'd you guys do? How'd you record this? That's the way we wanted it to sound. You know, and finally they went to the wizard guy up in Maine.
Bob Ludwig.
Yeah. And he got it. He went back to them and said, you know, this is screwed up. I don't know if I can do anything with it. That's what we want, man. It's a homemade record. He goes, okay. So I thought the same thing. I thought, okay, well, this is just homemade stuff. You know, if people want to quibble about the sound or whatever, or if there's, you know, some squeakiness in the acoustic guitar, whatever, you know.
But what I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I've acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
It really goes back to a lot of it's just instrumental guitar, you know, like, kind of like surf music in a way. My roots of my playing, being in Southern California and being a surfer, surf instrumental surf music, not the Beach Boys, not Jan and Dean, but, you know, the Shantays, Dick Dale, big one, Dick Dale, Pyramids, used to play in battles with bands, and, you know, we'd show up and we played every song on the first two Them records, Van Morrison and Them. Mm-hmm. That was our thing. You know, everybody else was copying the Rolling Stones or the Beatles.
Right.
But then there was these other guys, the Pyramids, that were wearing the metal flake blue suit jackets and playing instrumental surf music. Those guys would always win. We were even in a battle of the bands one time at Dutch Village in Long Beach with the Carpenters.
Really?
Yeah. Check it out. If you read stuff about them, they talk about being in battles of the bands in the early days.
That's funny.
Yeah. These shopping centers would have these battle of the bands playing all over the shopping center. The first music that I played and loved was in instrumental, you know, surf music, basically. You know, that's a big influence. I mean, you can hear all the influences of my life in those. You know.
There's a lot there. I'm curious on I think it's on volume one, you do a cover of For What It's Worth.
Yeah.
What was the reasoning behind that? Was it the beauty of that song is it's never going to go out of fashion.
Right. This
something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. Think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going
down. I recorded that guitar track and I was listening to it one day and I just started, the changes are different than the Buffalo Springfield record, slightly different. But I was just, all of a sudden I started started singing along to it and I go, wow, it works. You know, on volume three, I did a cover of, I did Baby Please Don't Go.
Yes. Yep.
Same thing. I had this bass line that I recorded. It's one of those songs where the bass never changes. The bass just stays on do 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 boom. You know, and doesn't do any chord changes. But I bet I could sing Baby Please Don't Go over this, which I did. And then I did the slide guitar and the you know, kind of filled it out a little bit. And it worked. So that's the same thing with For What It's Worth.
So is it, you play all the instruments?
Yeah.
All three? Wow.
Yeah. And wow. I'm not playing drums, but I get good drum loops.
Okay.
So they're natural drums. They're not drum machines. So,
wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
I loved JJ's groove.
Okay. Yeah.
I want to know who JJ is.
Julia Joseph. Julia Joseph is the singer. I played in a wedding band called the Loyals.
Okay.
And actually we do like a acoustic version of it. Julia came to me and she said, because we with the Loyals, we play this James Brown song called I Know You Got Soul.
Okay.
You know, and the bass line is a little bit like that. And Julia said, wow, oh, what if you took that bass line? Maybe you could make something else of it, you know? And so I started, that just put the idea in my head. So I laid that down. And then I was thinking about, you know, Little Beaver, who played guitar on Cleanup Woman, Betty Wright.
Wow.
And just, you know, just the R&B feel and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's
a great song. I loved it. I really. And then the one that threw me for a loop, the next song, Good for Gonkin'. What the fuck is Gonkin'?
My girlfriend, when I say, hey, what are you doing? She says, I'm just gonking around.
Ah,
so,
okay.
You know, and I just, you know, when I listened to the music, I was thinking, yeah, this is the kind of music you could be gonking around on. So it's just hanging out in your house in your pajamas and stuff.
I have one really big question.
Yeah.
Why release all three at once?
Well, I released two on August 14th,
right.
One and two, and then I released the other one on September, I think, 18th when I was in Greece.
Correct.
And then the other one, I just had an idea that I wanted to do something for Halloween. You know, the reason I wanted to do it kind of all at once was because I was at a wedding a few months ago, and we were at the dinner, and I was sitting next to a really big music supervisor. And I was thinking, this is, you know, I want to get this stuff out there. I just want it to get out there, and then I'll start doing Instagram posts using it. I just got to get it, get exposure. So I was thinking about, okay, do you do the old thing where you, you know, 6 months and 6 months later? And I thought, no, I'm just going to, I'm going to put it out and just get it out there. And I'm planning on like a volume four, hopefully, maybe not December, but January or something like that. Cause I've got other stuff yeah, that's just as good.
I'm no longer a fan of the album, wait a year, wait 18 months, release another album. Yeah. I don't think we live in that world anymore.
I agree.
You need to parse work out as it's available and as it makes sense, right? I was a little bit floored by how much you released. I just think it makes more sense to release everything in a timely manner. I'm going to ask you one last question before I release you. Do you have an abandoned album? An album that, not you personally, that you love, that think people should hear more about?
You know, I was, when we were talking about albums I had produced, there was another band that I worked with called Thin White Rope. And I did a record call with them called Exploring the Axis. Okay, these guys were from Davis, California, which is like by Sacramento, kind of a, you know. And I remember they came down. I worked with them with Dennis Dragon in his studio in Malibu. And I go, where are you guys staying? We're camping up at Leo Carrillo State Park. I go, you're camping? Because I said, you know, we're going to be doing this for like at least 2 or 3 weeks. And I love that band. And they were really off the wall. I mean, they were really out there. The lead singer, Guy Kaiser, I remember, was a really interesting guy. But anyway, that's a record that I, you know, but I mean, people, whenever a song from that album comes on and I'm driving in the car with my girlfriend, she'll look at me like kind of a really puzzling look. But these guys had a very forward concept in you know, for the time when we recorded that record. And I love the sounds that Dennis got on that record. I mean, it was just them playing live in the studio. And I mean, there was no enhancement afterwards. It was just the sound they made was really interesting to me. That's a record.
Well, Jeff, you've had an incredible career. I appreciate you taking the time. Folks, we're in an actual recording studio. Jeff came up from New York, and I drove over from New Haven, and we are actually face-to-face.
Yeah.
You can't see it now, but because this is an audio podcast, but thank you very much. I appreciate this.
Oh, my pleasure, man. This was really nice talking to you. Really nice meeting you face-to-face.
Yeah, yeah.
Last time it was just on the telephone or something.
It was, this is great. I wish you continued success.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to more of your work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look me up on Bandcamp. Jeff Irick on Bandcamp.
Yep. And you are on the socials?
Yes. Instagram. As a matter of fact, on Instagram, Jeff under Potmos, because we didn't even get into the non-music stuff, but
yeah,
you're going to see a lot of pictures of octopus.
The beings that live under the sea.
Yeah. And that's why I go to Potmos. I take pictures of octopus in their natural environment.
That's intense.
Around Potmos. Yeah. Yeah. But it's a wonderful experience. It's amazing.
Well, thank you again.
Yeah. Thank you, man.
Dude, I really appreciate it.
Yeah. My pleasure. This was, see the place?
It's a great place.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to still do it, but the problem was.
Thank you to Jeff Irick for making the trek up to Connecticut to chat in person. Also, thanks to Nathan Sage at Sage Sound Studio for making it happen. Please check out the show notes section for links to Jeff's work. You'll also find a hand-selected Spotify playlist of songs that Jeff has selected to highlight his career.
This episode of Abandoned Albums was written and produced by Keith R. Higgins. The show was recorded at Thunder Love Studios, where it was engineered by
Daphne Miller,
with help from
John Thomas.
Abandoned Albums was edited by
Mike Hunt.
The songs you heard during this podcast were Exotica Blue by Jeff Irick, San Francisco, Be Sure to Wear Flowers in Your Hair by Tanya Tucker, Million Miles Away, first by the Plimsolls and then by the Goo Goo Dolls, and Born in East L.A. by Cheech and Chong. You also heard Small Black Heart by Dave's True Story, Fork in the Road by Electro, and Number One Blues Street, For What It's Worth, and JJ's Groove, which were taken from Jeff's Rogers Street albums. Be sure to check out the show notes section for links to everything. Please support independent music.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
Our theme song is All I Want by Pete Belasco. In the opening of the show, the songs you heard were Livin' in a Dream by Archangels, Think Too Hard by Sid Straw, and Stronger Than Love by James Carr.
If you like what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. Thanks for listening.
Grazie.
Daily Leaf.
Rob Janicki. Mike Pellegrino. Therina Vella. Ronnie Barnett. S.W. Loudon. Michael Janicki. Peyton Janicki. And our executive producer.
Rufus Thunderwolf.
Abandoned Albums receives funding from Cramerica Industries. Protect what you value. Cramerica Industries, made in America by Americans, mostly, and headquartered in America. Cramerica.com.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Paw Print Media.